Welcome to Energy in Transition, a weekly series of virtual fireside chats, where we'll be speaking to key movers and shakers in the clean energy sector to get their expert views on the future of the industry, how we get to net zero, and how things are being affected by COVID-19. My name is Jim Jordan. I'm an energy lawyer at the leading national law firm, Waitmans, where I specialise in construction and commercial aspects of projects. Each week, we're going to be tackling a different topic, and today we're going to be discussing battery storage. I'm delighted to be joined by Marek Kubik from Fluence. Now, we've only got 15 or 20 minutes, but Marek's CV is really rather impressive. He's a market director at Fluence. He's a recognised industry influencer and leader. He's spoken at TED conferences, he's spoken at the United Nations, One Young World, and Forbes Summits. And not that long ago, Marek was honoured by Forbes 30 Under 30. Marek, thanks so much for joining me today. Before we start, please could you introduce yourself and Fluence in a little more detail, perhaps, and also a beginner's guide, as it were, to exactly what we mean by battery storage?
Yeah, sure. Happy to, Jim. So thanks for inviting me to join. So Fluence, if your listeners are not familiar, is an energy storage technology company. So put simply, we design, install, deliver large-scale energy storage systems, predominantly on the grid, predominantly for independent power producers, utilities, and the like, basically to help integrate renewable energy to the grid. And fundamentally, battery is exactly what it sounds like. It's the same technology that that's been around for several hundred years. 1799, the first electrochemical battery was invented by Alessandro Voltaire, and really the lithium-ion battery, which is predominantly what's being used today in a lot of these energy storage systems, has been around since the 70s, and we're very familiar with it for our phones, our laptops, iPads, and so on, consumer electronics. But increasingly, it's been used now for stationary storage and largely also electric vehicles. And it's really electric vehicles that have driven the uptake of lithium-ion batteries and significantly increased the volumes that are being produced, which has brought down the cost. But we're taking the same basic technology that's used across all of those sectors and putting them in stationary energy storage systems, putting them at strategic points around electricity grids, basically to charge up and discharge at other times, so they're rechargeable, obviously. So essentially to help integrate renewables to the grid and solve various challenges that system operators would face.
Okay, thank you. And your particular role within Fluence, I've worked with you before. I know you you travel around a lot, you keep very busy.
I did, pre-COVID. This is week 7 of lockdown now here, so I've been grounded for a little while. But yes, I have a role spanning a few different markets. So predominantly, I lead the team for UK and Ireland, to a lesser extent, Middle East and Africa. But the UK and Irish markets are very busy for storage. So my role essentially spans sort of the origination BD through sales and up to and including contract negotiations. And then at the point we've sort of signed projects with customers, it's handed over to our deployment team, our execution team.
And for those people who perhaps aren't familiar with Fluence and your business, could you just give us some examples on the sorts of projects that you've been working on over the last sort of, say, 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, sure. So, Fluence is actually only 2.5 years old as a company, as an entity. So we're a joint venture between Siemens and AES, both of whom are very large players in the energy space. But we've been standalone for about that period. And really, I would say it's characterized by massive growth globally. When we launched January 2018, we had 400-500 megawatts of projects either operational or awarded. So contracts signed, and in the that sort of period, we've grown to something around approaching 2 gigawatts. So it's a really phenomenal growth rate, and I mean if you plot it exponentially, it's very much following that sort of trend. Some of the particular projects of note recently, one that I find very interesting is first in new markets or first for new applications. So we recently, earlier this year, delivered for Statkraft, a project in Ireland. It's the first project in the Republic of Ireland that's come online as energy storage, particularly for providing grid services and for relatively new forms of grid services. So some of your viewers and listeners might be familiar with frequency regulation in the UK. The Irish market has an equivalent of that, but it's actually rewarding significantly faster response times. And we're talking orders of magnitude faster than the UK because of the stability challenges that the small grid like Ireland faces when there's very high levels of wind. And really, energy storage is starting to show that it can help provide digital equivalents of inertia and the kind of services you need to get more renewables on the grid in real time, which is obviously important if you want to get to 100% renewables at some point.
And sort of parking COVID-19 just for a moment, what other challenges do you see energy storage facing? It's obviously, it's getting a lot of press and it has done for quite a while now. What do you see as being the key challenges for now, excluding the COVID-19 pandemic?
So to unpack that, I think there's two ways that I would answer it. One is an awareness issue. There is a lot of things you can do with battery energy storage. And the irony of it is not much of it is actually about what people think it is about, which is the perception that you're using the battery specifically to co-locate with, say, wind and solar and to store the energy on the site. It is much more at the moment about solving grid stability challenges that let you, on a system level, integrate high levels of wind or solar or non-synchronous generation in general. And solving the network constraints that limit that as well. So obviously the grid is there. It's quite difficult to upgrade transmission distribution lines, and the way that we generate electricity as we move to more distributed and variable sources has to become more flexible. And energy storage is really key for solving several of those, but it requires a sort of shift in thinking to allow storage, allow technologies like batteries to compete against poles and wires, or to compete against peaking power plants, or to provide the equivalent services that thermal generation would provide, like inertia, like frequency response. So an awareness that is possible, and to remove the regulatory barriers that prohibit it, because often the barriers are not intentional. We reward, for instance, in the UK, frequency response in 10 seconds, because that's what thermal plants could do in the past. The fact that you can respond faster and has value needs to be recognized, and it is being recognized, but there are other things like the transmission and distribution network, which it's still very difficult to get a battery in and say, hey, we can do an equivalent job and better. So that's probably one of the main barriers. It's just recognition and then removing the hurdles that are in the way. And the second would maybe be the misinformation lobby. So there was a big, the first phase of battery storage was people saying, it can't be done. You can't do these services with batteries. And technically very proven that it can, and commercially that it makes commercial sense. So now I see the arguments, the barriers have moved on to, there isn't enough lithium, or you can't recycle batteries. And there's responses to each of these points. And basically they can be very robustly addressed, but the more they're repeated, the more it sinks in as a perceived truth. So I would say those two, outside of COVID, are probably the big ones.
Okay, that's really interesting. I suppose the million-dollar question, which no one really knows the answer to, is the impact of COVID-19. We don't know what's going to happen in the coming days, weeks, and months, and even years to the economy and to the way that we work and operate. But do you think what's happening now will substantially impact the development of battery storage or investment in battery storage projects?
It depends answer.
Yeah.
So the way that I view energy storage and in general the complementary nature of deploying renewables is, to an extent, those two trends are inevitable. And regardless of COVID-19 or anything else, they are happening and are going to continue happening, because renewables have become the cheapest form of electricity generation. So if you have cheaper cleaner energy and you don't compromise reliability, and you can get the same level of reliability from that grid. By definition, that's a win-win-win on the policy trilemma. So it'll happen. But what matters is how quickly it will happen from a climate crisis perspective. And this is where I think the uncertainty of COVID, it could go either way. On the one hand, we've certainly, albeit it's not necessarily the recommended economic way of significantly reduced emissions, we will see a huge dip in global emissions this year as a result of the short-term impacts of COVID. And we're seeing, essentially with record low oil prices, massive oversupply, falling away of demand, a lot of oil companies shuttering wells, and probably permanently. So there is a real opportunity there to reset on a low carbon pathway and a low carbon economy. But on the other hand, it could just rebound and we continue not exactly business as usual, because as I said, I think the renewables and storage trends are inevitable, but certainly we don't necessarily accelerate the reduction of emissions if we go back to doing things as normal. My view is there are some silver linings in the situation, and we're seeing that through clean air, lower traffic deaths for people traveling less, things like that, that might well play into policymakers' views, particularly as a lot of them have put out, net zero legally binding targets, and they have to do these things anyway in law.
And do you think that what's happening at the moment will require a change to the way that deals are done or deals are structured? Or are you seeing a sort of a fairly consistent approach followed through on deals being implemented and structured?
Do you mean specifically the contract phase of projects, or you mean in general sort of across the piece?
A bit of both, really. I think, I guess, so on the contractual side of things, obviously technology is changing very quickly in the battery storage market. So you've got some long-term operating arrangements, but I suppose the question there is, where will the technology be in 5, 10, 15 years' time? Mm-hmm. And also, how will COVID-19 sort of impact operational requirements for projects, and whether that changes things going forward as to how projects are operated. But I guess also, given the what you read in the press around potentially the lack of finance being available, do you think that's a major concern, or do you think we just have to get battery storage going in greater quantities, because that's the only way we're going to get anywhere near net zero?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because there's a few different ways you can think about answering that. So partly, we actually aren't really seeing ourselves. There are obviously some challenges with COVID and influence organizationally. We're quite distributed anyway. We're all over the world in terms of our setup. So we have about 200 people plus contractors in different offices. So in a way, we're quite remote workers anyway. I was a lot on the road. So the immediate impacts of that, we decided to start working from home before it was sort of mandated in the UK or in Germany, for instance. And so we're quite used to that. But what is becoming, interesting is we've got some deals that were in, contract phase at the moment, and we've never really done that where everyone is remote and everyone's in a different place, both on the client and on the Fluent side. So it's interesting that experience to see how it will happen. So far it's been actually quite efficient, but I think a lot of people would have concerns that if you don't get heads in a room and really focus on getting stuff done, that it drags out. So I think there is a short-term mechanical, should we say, or process-based impact as a result. In terms of projects and pipeline, we're actually not seeing any slow up, and I think that's quite interesting. And if you look at the fundamental reasons for why that is, it's because energy is sort of underpinning to the whole of society in general. If anything is essential work, it's keeping the electricity flowing, because without it, you don't have ventilators, you don't have home deliveries of food, people aren't, comfortable and safe at home. So that work needs to continue. What I guess does matter suddenly in this period is the uncertainty about how companies will weather the initial storm. And in that regard, Fluence is pretty well set up. We're backed by two investment grade companies. Siemens, have been around 170 years, so it's a very dependable company to have standing behind us and know that Fluence will be there for to you know serve and maintain systems come what may with the situation. So from that standpoint, I think it matters in the short term to investors, and you might see a difference between those that are on the utility side looking to develop projects and those that are financial players looking to more speculatively build out energy storage based on merchant revenues, merchant business models. So the latter probably is more shaken because it's an equity-based environment, but equally we're seeing an environment where you'd have either utilities or infrastructure funds, those that can put debt or long-term money into projects and infrastructure. So it comes back to the earlier point around it depends what storage is used for. If you're playing in grid services, it's quite a market-based environment where the contracts are short or real-time. If you're looking at replacing poles and wires, you're entering a regulated utility space where an investment can get a 20-year contract and guaranteed revenue. And so in some markets, we see that. National Grid is starting to look at it for the UK for things like its Pathfinder projects, the constraint management, stability Pathfinders, and so on. So it's a long-winded way of saying, I think it depends. But it's definitely interesting to see how it's impacting things.
And you touched very helpfully on various sort of emerging trends that you're seeing in the market, where some things are changing, some things are staying the same. In terms of positive trends, one of the things that I'm hoping becomes the norm is the fact that, given the pandemic and people staying in, that the pathway to net zero is getting even more publicity than normal, because you're seeing on the front pages of newspapers pictures of coastlines and beautiful crystal clear seas, all linked to a reduction in activity, a reduction in boats, a reduction in industrial activity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sort of wondering whether, in terms of the emerging trends, what this is actually doing, what this thing that we're all going through, it's opening some people's eyes to the actual genuine impacts on our country, on our world, mm-hmm. that carbon has. And if people get a glimpse of what the outcome can be when we have reduced carbon, then it may be that some people who are perhaps quite cynical start showing more of an interest in the pathway to net zero, and start understanding that the likes of wind farms and solar farms combined with battery storage are the way forward. So it may be that you talked earlier about some of the sort of perception issues of battery storage and some of the sort of some false, some true stories that have been run on battery storage. But I think if nothing else, what we're going through is hopefully going to increase the public's understanding of how serious the situation is and how important it is to move towards net zero. So it's really interesting to hear your views more generally. I mean, do you think this is a temporary glitch? Or do you think using technology such as battery storage, applying it small scale, charging cars in your driveway, but also applying it larger scale, tying it into wind farms and solar farms, do you think, that is inevitable, isn't it? Irrespective of what's happening now, there's going to be a move towards net zero. But the question, I suppose, is, how much that's impacted or how much that's delayed, or in fact how much that whole process is speeded up on the back of the public perception of what the world looks like when we're not pumping out pollutants into the air.
It can go either way, and my I guess share an opinion, but it's a crystal ball view of, if you look at what COVID has done, it's ironic actually, because just today I had a Suncast podcast that I did recorded 7 or 8 weeks ago, so just before the lockdown started. I just got back from a flight and got home, and I did it late at night, and one of the things that came up in that was exactly the discussion around human behavior and human psychology, and what things did I think wouldn't change and would be, you know, just evident truths in energy. And one of the ones that I said, and now I probably have to reflect on caveat, was that human behavior won't really change. People want to use electricity. There's a subset that, you know, really care and will turn off, you know, lights or change their behavior or not use stuff for, you know, just the ethical environmental reasons. Many of us just do it, you know, if it's economical and it's convenient, we want to enjoy the same things. I talked about that from, you know, say, like food perspective. If you have vegan food that is as, you know, tasty and you know, enjoyable as meat, then, and it's the same price, people will very easily switch. Whereas if you just tell people not to eat it, some people will, but it's a harder push. And I think that's a very interesting reflection now to the COVID situation, because one of the few things that can really give a shock to the system and actually reset human behavior is what's just happened, and how serious this got. Because one of the big things that does impact our you know, carbon emissions and our footprint is travel to work. It's international travel. Suddenly we're all working from home and actually finding out that it's, well, you know, with exceptions, I appreciate everyone's situation's different, but it's actually, to, in some extent, got a lot of advantage. You save on the commute, you have more time in the evenings, you spend more time with your family, and you're doing that then for power emissions, without the flight emissions. So that's something that might well stick. I think if any human behavior thing does stick, it's that one, because organizations realize they can save money and time, probably productivity for it. The other aspect, it really depends on what rebounds or not. So with aviation, for instance, it's under a huge strain at the moment, and a lot of airlines potentially will go bankrupt or scale back services. Low-cost travel with airlines is probably going to reduce, at least for several years. Maybe it will never recover, and if it doesn't, that certainly accelerates the pathway to decarbonisation. On the other hand, if you know, airlines, oil companies are bailed out and can continue to survive, it, again, I think trends we've talked about are inevitable in the long term, but the pace of change, you can see it going either way. And I think the net zero point and joined up policy thinking on that could really accelerate things. So who knows, but yeah, there's some interesting things to think about and unpack there.
Okay, so I'm going to be slightly unfair with you now, Marek. I'm going to ask you a bit of a cheeky question. I want three words from you that represent getting us to net zero.
Renewables, batteries, faster.
Good answer. Okay, so unsurprisingly, I now want three words from you that represent stopping us achieving net zero.
Regulatory hurdles, policy. I don't know. It's quite difficult to form a joined up sentence, but I think you get the theme at least.
I get the theme, Eric, and the regulatory hurdles and policy all link back to my my business as a lawyer. So if you're suggesting that lawyers are holding things up, I take huge offence to that. Unfortunately, that is all we've got time for on today's session. Marek, that's been really, really interesting. There's some really good food for thought in terms of public perceptions, technology issues, and also the wider views on decarbonisation and how the world may look sort of post-COVID-19 if we ever get there. If anyone's interested in finding out more, I'm sure the Fluence website is a good place to start. Also, I'm sure Marek won't mind being contacted directly. He's definitely worth following on LinkedIn. He put some extremely interesting and thought-provoking articles up on LinkedIn, which are well worth a read. More generally, this interview will be published on the Waitmans website, which is waitmans.com, and it will also be shared on social media channels, including LinkedIn and Twitter. So all that remains for me to say is thank you for joining. There will be further fireside chats with other key players, so please watch this space.